Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
Okay, so I want to get to sort of a real focus on your relationship and you know, what led to marriage and the family. But I'd like to, if it's not totally disjointed with the sequence of your story, I'd like to kind of shift a bit and talk about, you know, coming out to your family, what the environment, family environment was like. I know, you know, your dad was like a, you know, all-star high school quarterback. I'm not sure if your mom was athletic or not. I know that you had at least a brother or two that played college basketball. So my guess is that masculinity is sort of maybe a part of your family in some way, traditional masculinity. And then there's the heavy church element. So tell me if it's a good time to talk about, you know, what it was like for you to think about, contemplate coming out, and then how that actually happened, and then how people reacted, or if there are other important parts of the story you need to tell first.
Sure. No other important parts of the story to tell. So Jeff and I had been together a year. How did this work? So it was June of 1991 when we started this summer institute, and he left for Houston in August. So we continued to see each other through that fall. And one of the things that happened was at that Christmas break, Jeff's from New York, and his dad lived at the time on the Upper East Side in Manhattan. And so he was going to go spend part of the break with his dad in New York City, and I was going to spend part of the break with my family in Utah, but then I planned to go to visit Jeff in New York. And at the time, I didn't think that was an odd thing to do. I thought, you know, wow, you're going to go, you know, spend part of a vacation in New York City. There's all kinds of things to do, et cetera. I think that was maybe the first time people in my family wondered whether there was something going on. I think they found it odd that I wouldn't spend the entire Christmas break with them in Utah, but instead would spend a few days with them and then go to New York and spend some time with Jeff. So, you know, my parents had met Jeff. I don't think any of my other siblings had met him yet. But I think now that I've talked with family members since that time, I think that raised people some questions. So, you know, in terms of what you said about, you know, representations of masculinity, all that was true. Having three brothers in addition to myself, and my sister was athletic and played sports, that wasn't an issue for me. That, you know, I it was more my fear in coming out to my parents was just I think it was a combination of, one, disappointing them. It was a fear of what that would mean in their relationship with me vis-a-vis the church and teachings about eternal families and all that kind of stuff. I didn't have those same doubts for myself. Like, I didn't struggle in coming out to myself with fears or doubts or concerns about my own eternal damnation or not being able to fulfill, you know, my callings that were determined in the pre-existence, et cetera, et cetera. That wasn't a struggle for me for myself, but it came into the mix when I thought about coming out to my parents. So in those first few months of being with Jeff, I couldn't imagine it. So he had geared himself up to come out to his parents that Christmas break. So, you know, what we had been together, not even 6 months. And he came out to his dad, and his dad's a great guy, politically liberal, New Yorker, all of that. And, you know, isn't without sort of his own challenges and understandings about what that meant. Like, one of the first things he said is, oh no, I'm not going to have any grandkids. So, you know, I think there are all kinds of associations people have. But largely Jeff had a positive coming out with his parents. His parents are divorced, so separately he came out to his mom right about that same time. So he was a little bit further along. At that time, I couldn't imagine it doing it. I couldn't imagine doing it myself. I think I just was still living with this fear. So for me, I had to stage it. So I was out to people who I, like my roommates that I lived with in Los Angeles. I was out to people who I'd come in contact with in affirmation, et cetera. But not yet to anybody from, you know, no childhood friends or family members. So the first person I came out to was my best friend. And that went positively. So I was, of course, nervous about it. So like I was visiting Utah. So it was probably that same Christmas. So that same Christmas when Jeff came out to his family, I came out to my friend, Dan.
A male friend.
Yeah. Yeah. My closest friend from childhood. We've known each other since second grade and went to college together. The two of us were roommates at University of Chicago the first year. So, and that went well. So it was terrifying and scary, but his reaction was great. And so that was sort of one under my belt, as it were, that went positively. I'm trying to remember the first family member. I felt like I had a strategy. So I was going to come out to all my siblings first because it was easier. So again, the fear in coming out, I guess, and it was never the fear of rejection. I never thought my siblings or my family or my parents never thought they would disown me, never thought they would be hateful, never thought they would, disown strong. I never thought there was going to be a significant rift as a result of doing this. It was just this fear of the unknown and the fear of disappointment and the fear of what this would mean on some level in our relationship going forward. So I felt like I needed to amass some allies for myself. So I came out to each of my siblings separately. And then it was the following.
How was it with your siblings? Was there any righteous indignation kind of stuff?
None. So none.
Nephi. There's no Nephi figure in your family. The sort of pious sibling that, you know, considered himself quite fondly.
Nope.
Wow.
So I count myself lucky in that regard. Yeah. So, I mean, currently my across the array of my siblings, they are at varying levels currently of activity in the church. Some are very active, others not at all. Anyway, and I'm not sure that was evident at the time that I came out to them, but even the siblings who are the most active now were generous and loving and gracious and handled it fine. Now, if I were, you know, I don't know. We haven't had deep conversations about what their views on gay people are, particularly as it relates to active Mormonism. Though they all came to our wedding. They all have been incredibly supportive. So on one level, coming out in that way just, I think, boosted my confidence. I needed to do a few trial runs. They all went positively. So I, up until that point, hadn't had a negative experience with coming out to anybody.
Okay, great.
So then leading up to my parents, so it was the following Christmas, the Christmas is 92.
Wait, I'm sorry. But I can't imagine that you would characterize your home as an LGBT-friendly home growing up, because I just can't imagine in the late 80s, the Bradshaw home in Orem, Utah being an ally family. So
no, it wasn't. It wasn't talked about.
Was it talked about negatively, like pejoratives used or anything like that?
I'm sure there were pejoratives used, probably even by me.
Right.
In my youth, but nothing on an overt level. You know, nothing really major. I mean, the couple of things I can remember is, I would guess my parents at the time I came out to them and in my youth would probably say they didn't know any gay people.
Right.
Or if they did, they were people who neighbors gossiped about or you know, or whatever, but didn't have any.
My guess is they knew about Bruce Bastian at that time, probably.
He wasn't even out at that time.
Oh, really?
No.
He was the just for our listeners, he's the WordPerfect co-founder that I interviewed a year or two ago. You can go back and watch that interview. But anyway, okay, so wow, he wasn't even out yet.
Yeah. You know, like I think, you know, I remember from my youth, like my dad, not railing or anything, but I remember him saying something like he didn't like Elton John because Elton John was gay.
Right.
Or I'm sure there were sort of philosophical conversations about, well, should gay people be able to adopt kids? And my guess is before I came out to my parents, they probably would have said no.
Right.
That's my guess. But it wasn't
it wasn't Spencer W. Kimball-esque either.
Correct.
Yeah.
It was not. So, you know, so then when I sort of internally decided, like, I got to tell my parents, like, because part of it was like, felt like I was sneaking around. So Jeff and I were seeing each other every month. You know, I would call my parents or they would call me and either Jeff would be there or I would be with him in Houston or he would be with me in Los Angeles. And I just felt like I can't live like this anymore. I'm misrepresenting this. It's not feeling right. So I don't know that I read the book. There are probably all kinds of books about how to come out to your family. And maybe I consulted those resources. I don't remember, but I know I had a plan. I had thought about it enough. I was going to be at home over the Christmas holiday. I had decided beforehand that I needed to tell them separately, partially because I think I felt like their reactions were going to be somewhat different, that their concerns would be different. And I wanted to, you know, meet each of them where they were. And I just felt like it was going to be easier for me in a one-on-one conversation rather than a one-on-two. Now, maybe that, as it turns out, was unfair. I mean, there were some crazy things happening that right at that time. It's known in our family lore as the Christmas from hell. So I say that fondly. My family says it fondly, just because it was all these things were happening. So my sister had just given birth to twins, like right before I was coming. So my mom had been planning to go spend like a month with my sister to help her. And those twins would have been her fourth kids. So my sister needed some help. My mom was planning on going. The other thing is like half the family at the time got the flu. So everybody was sick and vomiting and all this stuff. And then I decided to come out to my parents during this period. So I told my mom before she was going to get on a plane the next day to go to my sister's place to be gone for a month.
You told mom first?
I told mom first.
Wow.
Because I knew she was leaving and I wanted, you know, and I was like terrified to do it. So I did that. And then I asked her, she probably hates me for this, but I asked her not to say anything to my dad until after she had left.
Oh, man.
So that I could do the same with him. Right.
Yeah.
So sure. She didn't sleep that night, whatever. It was probably a disaster. So thinking back on it now, I know that was challenging for them. It was where I was at. So I don't really want to discount where I was at the time because I felt like it was important to come out and to do it. And that's the way I could conceive of doing it at the time. I wish it could have been different. Anyway, so I told my mom, you know, we both cried. As I look back on it, I remember her telling me she loved me. You know, I tried to explain as best that I could. And I also felt like I needed to be really concrete and really specific. So I felt like I needed to say to her, I'm with Jeff. We've been sexual. We're together. I don't want to change. I'm not going to go see anybody. So I felt like I had to sort of lay this all out and be very specific because I didn't want there to be a lot left to the imagination.
Right.
So,
wow. Every mother's dream.
Every mother's dream. Right. So, I'm really glad I can laugh about it now. So, you know, she, so But it's very upsetting to her, right? So, you know, I mean, you go whatever all the stages of one's experience initially, having shock, then denial, then anger. You know, she went through all that stuff, but not in that sitting. You know, so she took it in, and I think at some point it was confirmation about what she knew already. So I bet she had probably known for at least a year, maybe a couple of years, and was just sort of waiting for it to be confirmed.
And was that atypical of your family? Because there are some families that just don't talk about anything intimate or serious. Like, you know, there could be a major indiscretion in the family and no one would ever talk about it, or a major illness and it just wouldn't be discussed. Was your family the type that it wasn't unnatural to keep things from each other, or was it a different type of family?
It would feel unnatural to keep things from each other. I mean, how do I describe this? I remember sitting down and having a deep, long, detailed conversation with both my parents right after I got back from my mission, where I expressed a lot of these doubts. So we had a serious conversation about that. You know, I remember before I had come out to my parents, having read Randy Schilt's book and The Band Played On, that, you know, was a sort of a narrative description of the AIDS epidemic, and having a couple of arguments with my dad about sort of the scientific lack of response to the epidemic. So him, you know, being a little bit more defensive of the scientists and me being a little bit more critical. And so I think we did have a history, a pattern, an inclination in the family about talking about serious things.
Personal things?
Yeah, but personal things. Well, I mean, you know, we would talk about particularly around how I was doing in school, how I was doing in college, how I was doing on my mission. So those things, though, yeah, I mean, I get your question. I never would have, I mean, maybe this gets to my hesitance to come out to them for the relatively long period, or I don't know how long, what's typical for people, but my not coming out to them for that long, maybe that's an indicator that we could talk about lots of things except for those things.
Right.
Okay. But largely speaking, I knew I could tell them at some point, and I just, you know, I need a little bit of time.
Right.
Psyched myself up to do it and then dove in and did it.
So did your mom give you any, like, oh my gosh, this is terrible, or oh, please don't, or any sort of awful type comments or responses, or anger at you, or was she kind of resigned?
I think she, like in that moment, I think she was just taking it in. So not in that sitting. So, I mean, we'll get to my dad in a second.
Okay.
But I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit. So my mom went to Arizona, was helping my sister with her twins. And I then made a trip from Los Angeles to Arizona to go see her during that period of time. So to continue the dialogue, to continue to talk about it and deal with their concerns. So I think at the time, in that first conversation with her, I was probably still making meaning for myself about what it meant to be gay, and probably was, I know I wasn't as comfortable then as I am now, or even 5 years after I came out. So I think at the time I was probably hedging a little bit, like, you know, because at that point I hadn't been with women. So I think in that conversation, my mom saying, well, how do you know? If you've not been with a woman, how do you know? And couldn't really answer that question, but it was important to me to tell her, I don't have an interest in that, and I'm not going to try, you know? So I was pretty clear about drawing some boundaries. Like, I'm not going to entertain fixing myself, changing myself, or even calling myself bisexual.
Right.
So I think she sits with that for a while. And like I was saying about sort of the stages of acceptance, I think she went then from some shock to probably some denial. And she got to an angry place. And it was not, I mean, I think she probably would say now she feels guilty about saying or writing whatever she wrote. I'm not sure if we had a conversation or if she wrote me a letter about it, but I think she was like, how, you know, her point of view was, how could you do this to our family? You know, how, you know, what you're doing selfish.
Oh, okay.
So I think that was that angry period. And, you know, I won't deny that at the time it hurt, but knowing that people human beings require some time to wrap their heads around an event like this. So I totally, and I think at the time had read a lot about coming out. You know, I had given my parents some books and some other resources as well. There's a great one that I know that's called And Now That You Know. So I think that I would prepared myself to let my parents have their own experience for a little while, which might have included some of this stuff. But I was committed to staying in the conversation with them. So I went to Arizona. We had some additional conversation about it. I think at that point she had lots of questions. I answered all her questions. And then I can't really remember exactly when the switch was flipped. The other thing that happened soon thereafter that was probably good was my parents had decided to temporarily move to Boston. My dad took a sabbatical from BYU and was working in a lab in Boston. So this actually gave them an opportunity to get away from their neighbors. So, you know, they were still closeted, as it were. So I had come out to them, but they weren't telling anybody. And it gave them this period to do some reflection, to do some of their own work around this. And they were able to do it in, you know, a faraway place that actually had a bunch of resources. So I sent them to PFLAG, Parents of Lesbian Gays, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. In Boston, they went to meetings there. They had, I think, an opportunity to kind of get out of their environment and deal with this a little bit more. Let me just say a quick thing about my dad, coming out to my dad. So Mom, you know, going back to that Christmas from hell, Mom gets on a plane, goes to Arizona, tell Dad the next day. And I think he was more shocked, perhaps didn't anticipate this coming. And I think for him, this is a generalization and is probably not fair to either of my parents, given that who they are as full human beings. But part of my experience and part of how I would characterize is my mom wearing her emotions a little bit more on her sleeve and my dad being a little bit more cerebral and intellectual about things. So he had questions. I think he was deeply concerned. And I think in the moment, it probably challenged a lot of his preconceived notions about who gay people are. I think it worried him also. Like, and I remember him saying, like, I'm worried I'm going to go to your funeral. So a lot of those associations about what it meant to be gay and what happened to gay people, you know, flooded into his mind. And I think he also took it harder, my approach of, I'm not going to go see a therapist. I'm not interested in being changed. I think he felt like this was an important, really critical decision for me. And he would have wanted me to have consulted my family, my parents, before I officially decided that I was going to do this. So I think it was harder for him to accept that, getting back to this theme of agency, that no, that's my decision. This is my sort of identity, and I don't need to ask your permission. I don't need to run it by you. And I didn't, and I'm not going to. And so I think he had some problems with that. And that was hard for him. So I think he was, you know, so then the rest of that trip when I was there, he was, you know, wringing his hands and, you know, probably didn't know what he was going to do. But again, communicated to me that he loved me, that he was going to stay in relationship with me. So again, looking back, it was hard. It was a relief that I came out, though even then, I think I had a sense that it didn't go as badly as it could have gone. So now as I look back on it, I think it was an important step for me, and I think of it positively in general. So then I think both my parents, I mean, the other thing, there are two things that are funny, maybe not so funny, but in my memory, what it was, I came out to them and probably a couple of months later, The Crying Game, the film, was released. Don't know if you remember that movie.
Isn't there some big scene where someone discovers that someone's a different gender than they thought or something like that?
Yeah. So it's a little...
I never saw it because back then I was conservative, so I wouldn't have seen such a bad movie. I just remember people talking about a scene where, is it a woman's a man or something
like that? Yeah, yeah. So it's an awesome movie. I love this movie. But anyway, but the thing about it is it got a huge amount of press, but it was miraculous in that this shocking surprise was largely kept under wraps in movie reviews. So a lot of people didn't know. So my parents went to see this movie, not knowing that this was happening. So the film takes place in the UK. So there's a sort of veteran of the Irish conflict, who goes back to sort of civilian life and seeks out who he thinks is the girlfriend of a fellow soldier that he knew, finds this person. This person is a gender bending. She's like a bartender or something. And in fact, she's biological male, but identifies as a woman. And he thinks she's a woman. They start to date. And then there's this scene where it's, you know, revealed that in fact, she is a he. And so my parents go to see this movie and I had just come out to them a few months earlier and they were totally shocked. And yeah, I just recount that story now in that these kind of issues are sort of all around them. And like I said before, I think at the time before I came out to them, they wouldn't have said, oh, I know a lot of gay people. But after I came out, it's like the colors in a black and white TV show or film start to pop out. You become aware, this comes into your awareness, and now it's all over and you can't get away from it. So they go to see this movie. The next thing they do is in a lovely, generous sign of solidarity, they decide they're going to go to the Pride Parade in Boston. And this is, you know, less than a year after I come out to them. And they go and have a very interesting and probably, as they would describe it at the time, a disturbing experience. Now, had they been marching in the parade, had they like gone with P-Flag and marched in the parade, it would have been an entirely different experience. You know, like when you're a parent and you're marching in the parade and everybody on the sidelines looks at you and projects, you know, their wish that their parents were like the people who were marching, you get these adoring looks and waves and everything else. But instead they were observers from the side and they see, you know, all of the pride floats go by. They see the man in scanty clothing, scantily clad. They, you know, see half-naked people. They probably see the dykes on bikes, you know, bare-breasted, all of this. And they're shocked and haven't come to terms with the fact that their sons just come out to them. And they sort of identify what they think their son's life is going to be with sort of these images and these representations in front of them.
Right.
So I just tell both of those stories to sort of say that it was a journey for them. You know, I think both the approaches of both my parents, I think, are also evident in the way they kind of tackled this independently. So my mom is much more of sort of constructs knowledge socially. And so for her, going to those PFLAG meetings was really important to like disclose and tell people her story and get connection by meeting other people. I think my dad in those meetings, as I recall having them tell me about them, was a little bit more reserved and a little bit less willing at the time to sort of tell all and put his feelings out there for people he didn't know all that well. I think they both read voraciously, so they read a lot. They became informed. I think they both realized that they weren't educated and weren't informed about issues of sexual orientation and sexual identity. So they did their homework. They read, they learned, they met other people. And then after they completed this temporary period in Boston, they moved back to Utah. I began to put them in touch with some other families in Utah from a Mormon background that were dealing with having gay and lesbian kids. This period was before Family Fellowship had been formed. There was a group in Salt Lake City called People Who Care, which was sort of a precursor to Family Fellowship. I think the woman who had started that group, her name was Jerry Johnston, something like that.
Right.
Who was a really significant person in getting some of this work going. So Gary and Millie Watts were sort of connected to that group. So my parents began to seek out some support for themselves around this, you know, and so then little by little, I forget when they first, or when the next time that they, well, they had met Jeff, but the next time that they spent any significant time with Jeff, I think, again, we had gone back to New York to be with Jeff's dad, and they were in Boston at the time, and they came down to New York, and we spent some time together. And it was, you know, I won't describe it as easy. I think there were awkward moments, and they were getting used to it, but they were trying, and I knew they were trying. So we had continued to talk and to try to make collective meaning about what this portended for me. And they were doing their due diligence. So I am totally, extremely grateful for the way in which they went about both finding information, finding support for themselves. And so it probably took a year or two, and they began to sort of make sense of this. And I think, like it is with a lot of people who start to figure out or have people come out to them, or when they begin to get to know somebody who's LGBT, that the closer you get to somebody, the stereotypes, the associations that you hold start to fall away. And so, and I observed that in my parents, and they both in different ways had, through my upbringing and then more recently into my early adulthood, had shown a strong sense about social justice, but largely not around the LGBT question. It had come up more around race and about gender and about gender roles and about how people of color are treated. And so I think when I came out to them, after some initial getting accustomed to what that was like, they began to use their social justice frame about, well, why should LGBT people be marginalized in the same way? And they began to question, I think, some of the commonly held attitudes about LGBT people.
Right.
So it took a couple of years. My parents warmed up. The thing I always say is, I mean, obviously, I appreciate and love Jeff, and for many reasons, and that's why we've been together for 22 years. But it's almost as if, in terms of my parents, it's like, what's not to like? You know, he is a great guy. And so if they could just get past the fact that he's a man, then things would be fine. So I think they, as they began to get to know Jeff a little bit more, they were able to build a independent relationship with him and to appreciate him for the person that he is.
Real quickly, did he grow up with a religious background?
He did. So his parents split when he was 9 or 10. And up until that point, he did not. But as part of their divorce and their sort of becoming independent of each other, they both sort of then dove into their own respective religions. So his mom became active in the Episcopalian Church and his dad in the Unitarian Church.
Okay.
Both of which are, generally speaking, very LGBT affirming on, you know, in different ways.
Right.
So he was, you know, he, depending on who he was with, his mom or his dad would, he was active in youth groups in both the Unitarian and the Episcopal Church.
Okay. So I'd like, if it's okay, I'd like to shift gears a bit now. And I want to direct at least this next section directly at, let's just create a picture of the young 20, 21, 22-year-old, you know, gay or lesbian Mormon that comes off their mission, that maybe they've been bargaining for the, you know, a same-sex attraction to be taken away. Maybe they've tried desperately through therapy or through religiosity or through dating to date the opposite sex, and that hasn't worked. And they're just sort of staring down what they might think is this barrel of potentially having to take some of the same steps that you've taken. But in spite of the fact that it's 2013, they're scared, petrified about what this means for their faith, their worldview, their family relationships. You know, I think you've laid out sort of a model that even in 2013, many would could only dream for in terms of a familial and parental response. So in some ways, you're very atypical, even by today's standards, I would say, in the LDS world, not to disparage LDS people, it's a tough situation. But the thing I want to talk about specifically is dating and sex, because what can you talk about to this 22-year-old, 24-year-old Mormon male who says, I can't date women, but I'm scared as heck to date men. I don't know where to start. I don't know what to do with all these stereotypes that I have in my mind. And most importantly, how in the heck do I handle sexuality? Because in my experience, these men haven't been sexual at all with anyone. You know, maybe they've masturbated, maybe they've, dated a bit, but most of them have had no sexual experience of any type. So I don't want to say that I'm like encouraging people to, break the law of chastity or, violate the commandments. But the reality, again, is that 70% leave the church. And so for those who are going to leave, what would you say to that young man? And if you can apply it to women, that's great too, about how they should approach exploration, dating, and sexuality.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I appreciate the dilemma. I think you've categorized it. You've described that dilemma pretty well. So I want to talk about it in a couple of different ways. So one, my attitudes about this, they certainly weren't formed at the time I was going through it myself, though on some level, the fact that I had decided to be sexual with Jeff when I did, I had the conversation about, we sort of acknowledged our attraction to each other. And then the point at which I had sort of decided, all right, I'm going to go forward with a relationship and it's going to include a sexual relationship, was relatively short. But the lens I want to look through now is this lens of systemic oppression. And this might seem sort of incongruous right now, but it's this sense that the dominant sort of ideas about sexuality are from a heterosexual perspective, that in fact, the majority of people are heterosexual. And it's this sense that's informed through, history and attitudes that have largely been anti-gay over a long period of time, that the homosexual LGBT people are on the margins. And in fact, that the dominant prevailing way of expressing sexuality is solely heterosexual. And that particularly then in the Mormon community, that if you would describe it as being progress, that now the institutional LDS church says that it's okay to identify as LGBT so long as you don't engage in behavior that is homosexual. So the way I look at that is, so deeply, deeply for me, that is unjust and is about the dominant culture oppressing behavior that doesn't look mainstream and doesn't look the same, doesn't look like the way it's expressed by the majority of people in either in the church or in society or in the world. So what I would do with whomever, a young man, young woman, is first totally empathize with the situation. That situation sucks, no way around it. So, rather than speak in absolutes about what people's experience is, I think it's important to empathize and really listen to what someone's experience is, because it looks really different. My experience, so I don't hold up myself as a model or the right way to do anything. It's just the way it happened for me. So for me, I knew at the time, I remember reading an essay by Eugene England in Dialogue, which may not have been the first time this idea was expressed, but certainly for me, it was the first time I saw it. This idea that we can be sympathetic and empathetic with LGBT people, but their orientation is the cross they have to bear. And if they want to remain active in the Mormon church, they're just going to have to be celibate. So for me, even at that time, and even more so now, the fundamental injustice of that is, to me, really profound. And something that, in fact, both of my parents have shared with me as well. Like, they have that same view. And I think it was fairly early on after I came out to them, particularly with my mom, her saying, like, how could I, who have enjoyed a very positive sexual relationship with my husband, this is probably going to embarrass her profoundly, but having a positive sex life with my husband and then actually deprive my son of having that as well. So for that young person who's sort of wrestling with all of this, you know, I think I would want to listen and be empathetic and then also just share what my experience is, that for me, I wasn't able to do it and wouldn't dream of doing it. You know, wouldn't dream of living a life where I could identify and accept myself as being gay, but not allow myself to explore that part of myself. Now, it's hard to, in that moment where you have to meet, in my view, you have to meet somebody where they are. So for me to either recommend that they throw their commitments to their religion to the side, or to, you know, recommend that they stop being active and just jump in, to me is disingenuous. Is I can say what worked for me, but I think people need to sort of think through and explore what that means. What would a commitment to one's faith and one's religion require you to do, and at what cost would it come if it meant that you weren't able to date or you weren't able to express yourself sexually with somebody that you care deeply about?
So the classic argument that I'll just put forward, because I've heard it many times, is, hey, there's plenty of single people in the church. There's plenty of people who, you know, think of the 40, 50-year-old woman or man that just never was able to find that special someone, but they, you know, are committed to the Lord, and, you know, why not, you know, they're able to do it, and this is your cross to bear. So there's kind of that argument, and then there's the argument of, you know, we all, and I know this is offensive, so know that I know that this is offensive, but there's always the, you know, some people, you know, have genetic dispositions towards alcoholism or towards other types of illnesses, let's just say, and, you know, part of being committed to the gospel and righteousness is overcoming the natural man and foregoing earthly pleasure or satisfaction in exchange for eternal reward. Now, I'm not asking you to challenge this person's theology, because obviously if you really believe in the gospel, you know, you might not see any other option than either celibacy, mixed orientation marriage, or leaving the church. But so I'm not asking you to even touch the theological stuff, even though I brought it up. But what would you argue about the risks or the implications of attempting celibacy, just in terms of how it might affect you physically or emotionally or psychologically?
So again, I would describe it through my own experience, which has been that I couldn't reconcile it. So I felt like, and for me, it's fundamentally tied to the way I was raised and to the way I experienced Mormonism. So when I first started to have attractions for Jeff, I felt like I not only had the opportunity and had the agency to honor those feelings, but that I had to, that it was being true to myself, that in fact, if I weren't to explore that part of myself, that would be going against who I was as a human being. So I know there are people who are committed Mormons who might say that's a rationalization, that's a justification. And I've heard all of the same things. But again, for me, it was about, am I going to live a fulfilling, happy life or am I not going to? And the thing I would say about, you know, people's response to or people's suggestion that there are single people in the church who haven't been able to find someone. And what I would say is those people are oppressed too. And if you were to gather single people in the church and have them talk about their experience, my guess is that you would find that those people would articulate being marginalized, would have their own challenges that would not stand up and say, this is a great experience for me overall. So the lens that I look at it now is informed with some of my professional work that I hope we'll get to a little bit later, but it's this idea of systemic oppression and how dominant cultures tend to represent and control behavior by marginalizing. And a lot of it is done on a conscious level, and a lot of it is done on a subconscious level. So, and you know, I don't even know how to respond sort of about the alcoholism. But again, I think the analogy to alcoholism, or people also say if there were a pill that you could take that would change you, again, making the expression of sexuality in either in a gay, lesbian, bi, trans context as being an illness or being a unnatural or out of the mainstream, I think it's just also informed by my worldview. So hard for me to know how to respond to it sort of in a intellectual kind of a way, other than it's just to say, you know, to me, it falls in a whole different category that that's also informed by science and the study of human sexuality and the study of sort of the biological origins of sexual orientation and sexual identity. So
that they're fundamental to happiness and health.
They're fundamental to happiness and health. And that in fact, so, you know, I wouldn't fully say to somebody, I can guarantee you that you're going to be miserable and unhappy if you don't accept this part of yourself. Though I think there are studies and research and data that suggest that people who are wrestling with this on a deep, deep level are at greater risk for some unhealthy health outcomes, socio-emotionally and physically, in terms of drug use, alcohol use, suicide, depression, other bad outcomes. So, and again, those things, in my view, because of how I've been trained and what I've learned, is not that those things are causal as a result of one's, they're not inherent to a person because of one's sexual orientation, meaning LGBT people aren't inherently more likely to use drugs, to be depressed, et cetera. But there is definitely a causal relationship, a correlation between people who are in an oppressed population and the incidence of those kinds of things.
And that kind of speaks to Caitlin Ryan's work with the Family Acceptance Project, that it's not so much, quote, the gay lifestyle that takes people down. It's the family and the social rejection. Well, so I'll take another, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, John, you support, you know, gays and lesbians and gay marriage, so you support what they like to call the gay lifestyle, which I also know is an offensive term to many, probably most. But, you know, what they mean when they say gay lifestyle is rampant sexuality with multiple partners, even multiple partners at the same time. I mean, all sorts of awful sexual stereotypes that go on. And I guess I wanted to start by asking you a question and then have you go back to that young man who's decided he's going to date, you know, what tips you'd give him and how to do that if he's made the decision to do it. But what's wrong with living a gay law of chastity, which would be to say, okay, I'm going to find my Jeff, but I'm not going to have sex with them till we're married. I'm going to not have sex with anyone until I'm married. I'll just live a gay law of chastity. Is that something you would be inclined to be supportive of, or skeptical of, or even adversarial towards?
not adversarial towards, I guess, some qualified support for. I mean, part of the reason it's not an option is because gays and lesbians can't get married in the vast majority of states, right? So it actually is not. So if you talk about an equal playing field, so first of all, the characterization I would object to is that gay people engage in promiscuous sex with multiple partners at any higher rate than straight people do. Don't believe that that's the case. So all you have to do is look at Tiger Woods. Reject it altogether. That there's any, all that is, in my opinion, is a way to marginalize and characterize as gay people as perverse, as a way to say we have moral indignation and we disapprove of gay people morally. I don't think it's rooted in any factual evidence. Now, the point about, you know, would it be a valid choice for somebody to live the law of chastity? I think absolutely, but there's not a level playing field. So if young people had positive role models, if, and I'm talking about in an LDS context, if young people heard from the pulpit representations of gay young people dating, saw representations of gay marriages in the temple, if there were no ordering or listing or sorting and selecting of what's good, what's okay, what's not, I think absolutely, and if the playing field were level, absolutely. So then, in fact, somebody could say, you know what? I get value out of holding off on engaging in sexual activity until I, like, it's important to me to have some demonstration of commitment. And for me, that looks like marriage. And that's what I've decided to do. So, yeah, I don't have any, I also wouldn't judge somebody who said, you know what, that isn't for me. So, again, I'm not, I don't find myself often being in a position of judging someone or telling them what their experience ought to be. So even in my case, right now in California, you can't get married legally. I got married during the short period of time when it was legal to do so. There are, 10 or 12 states now where gay marriage is legal, but it's not the same. Right. For a young person, the experience, the policies, the practices, and the cultural representations of gay people are not on the same level as they are for straight people.
Right.
So it's just, yeah.
So I want to come to, I want to move to your decision to get married and what it's like with your family. But let's just talk really briefly. I'm thinking of that 24-year-old gay male who's decided I'm leaving the church and I'm going to date men and I'm going to explore my sexuality, but they're like scared, you know, witless. What advice do you give them about how to do that in, you know, a way that's healthy or even moral, if you can?
Yeah. Well, so I'm not sure that I can, one, because that wasn't my experience. So I didn't really date anybody, you know, like Jeff and I sort of met during this period where I would sort of talk about our connecting when we were in college. I wouldn't even really call that dating. So I sort of felt like I was lucky enough to have that set of events happen and have the timing of it happen such that it worked out for me. I fell in love with this person and he's the only person I've been with. He's the only person I've been in a relationship. He's the only person I've been with sexually. And that's unusual. So hard for me to give dating advice to somebody when I haven't dated.
Oh, yeah. Myself. Okay. Okay.
Right. You know, so, you know, in terms of like the stereotypic question is, well, do you meet people in the bars? Do you meet people? You know, how do you meet, you know, all of that. So I don't have a lot of experience to draw on, but what I would say to anybody, young person, man, woman, et cetera, is that you've got to sort of find ways to authentically be yourself. And sometimes that, and I'm not saying that doesn't happen in a bar or online or in the workplace or in school or even in church, right? So you know, you meet people. So I know a lot of people, gay folks from LDS backgrounds that met in church, that met somehow at some LDS kind of a function. I know people who have met people online and then started a date and it's worked out for them. So again, I think that it's about this dynamic between doing some of the internal work to do some of the self-acceptance. And I think some of that self-acceptance is hard to do, but it's necessary, particularly because then it involves learning to love yourself and understanding that you deserve to have a solid, good relationship. So I think a lot of times we internalize the messages about you don't deserve it. Gay relationships are false relationships, or they're perverse relationships, or whatever. And it takes a lot to be able to think that through and reject some of those things, though you don't always, particularly with how the brain works, you don't always, you know, rid yourself of all of those associations that you've grown up with, that you've internalized all of that. So I think it would be some dynamic between, you know, doing some internal work, doing some self-acceptance, figuring out that you deserve to have a good relationship, a solid relationship, and that sort of forms a foundation for how you would go about meeting people and seeing the interactions and connections with other people of your same sex in a positive way, in a mature way, in ways so that you interact with people in ways that we all live our lives. So again, I want to make a reference to a sign I've seen at pride parades held by couples, particularly around some of the Prop 8 debate. It was a big sign that said sort of the gay agenda: 1, do the laundry; 2, take the kids to soccer practice, you know, whatever. So it was sort of normalizing the very existence of what it means to be a human being, to be a human being that happens to be gay or lesbian or bi or trans, which is you go about living your life in an authentic way. You go to work, you are contributing members to society, you have a satisfying job, or maybe you have an unsatisfying job, but you hope for a more satisfying job. You're in school, you're trying to live your life and do things in a normalized kind of way. And that's certainly been my experience, right? So whether it's, you know, making a decision to get married or have a kid, or the way I live my life in my work, or, you know, like I'm a good neighbor. I talk to my neighbors, whether they're gay, they're straight, whatever. I walk down the street, I nod to people as they walk past. Like, you know, I have human connection with people. The things that I want, the things that I desire, my intentions are common to what other people want. And so I think that's sort of the base, the foundation at which I would suggest to any young person coming out that you sort of do that internal work to come to terms with who you are and what you want. And then you live your life in an authentic way. And I would just say the likelihood that it's going to work out is much greater than if you beat yourself up about it and sort of continue to struggle, beat yourself up in this struggle.
And the common, I don't want to say common, but the, you know, there is this notion that I've heard of, the queer bounce. Have you heard of that term?
No.
Which is that, and it turns out that this isn't just an LGBT phenomenon. It can happen probably in all cultures and religions and societies, but it certainly can happen, for example, in the post-Mormon and ex-Mormon world, where, you know, you were defined so much by your observance of the law of chastity and the word of wisdom. And once you reject your faith of origin, then you can almost sometimes fall into the trap of becoming, you know, the reflection, the inverse of what you were. And that can mean, let's just say, a new adolescence where you're acting like a kid in a frat, in a fraternity, or a woman in a sorority, where you are doing some of those typical, let's just say, college kind of behaviors of lots of sleeping around and lots of you know, substance use or whatever it is, because why not? You know, you don't believe in the same things anymore, and it's fun maybe for some, and sometimes that can maybe be dangerous. And you know, there are diseases, and substances can lead to self-harm or harm of others. And so are those types of things, you know, real concerns that people need to look out for? Or are they overblown? And again, part of these stereotypes of oppression that are used to, you know, cause internalized homophobia.
So I would not say that they're not concerned. So the historical analog I would make is during the height of the AIDS epidemic, the question, the issue of the bathhouses. So both in San Francisco and in New York. So the idea being that in an environment of systemic oppression where LGBT people had been raised, had their identity been formed in a very oppressive society, and this happened, you know, in the 70s, right? So move to places like San Francisco and New York, and it became like this. So again, using your reference to the queer bounce, right? So getting to a place where they were in a ghetto, if you will, with lots of other gay people who have found the freedom. So there's all the tropes around sexual freedom, you know, the movement, not disassociated from women's liberation, from civil rights, the early parts of the gay rights movement. So at the time when people were suggesting that bathhouses be closed, you know, you can look at Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, that sort of articulates his experience in that period of time, that there were certainly negative health outcomes that were resulting from the behavior of primarily gay men in bathhouses and other places. Now, do I believe that a lot of that behavior, that expression of their sexuality, was certainly impacted and informed by systemic oppression? Yes. Am I sort of sympathetic to this thought that a rejection of some of that gay men themselves experienced a rejection of some of the social norms that had oppressed them? Yeah. I'm not one that, even though my experience has been a monogamous one, I'm not terribly judgmental of people who haven't lived that way and have made decisions where that isn't their experience. But what I would say, just in response to your question, is that I think it is the experience of a number of people that their inability to come to terms with their sexuality and their, you know, struggle with how they're marginalized can be expressed in unhealthy ways with sexual behavior, drug and alcohol use. I think that's a reality. Now, do I think that there are people who can use substances, drink, and live a non-monogamous life that are good people, and for them that it's the right choice? Yes, I think that's true as well. And I'm not sure if I'm being too sort of morally relativistic here, but I think it depends. I think it depends on the situation and for whom and what each particular person's experience is.
And just like there are varieties in the straight world, I know this is probably an offensive question, but could you find, you know, gay and lesbian individuals that do live a comparable version of the law of chastity and monogamy is really important to them and none of this, that there would be people who find, you know, that aren't open to open marriages or aren't open to other types of things, but it's just traditional morality and commitment and monogamy without any of the other stuff. Is that also within the realm of possibility and even practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's true for a number of the couples that I know, a number of gay couples, lesbian couples, people who are bi, who are in a same-sex relationship. So definitely. I mean, I have trouble with this, with these notions a little bit, because for me, I see myself as having made a number of choices that I wanted to make that are working for me. I feel like I'm living a full, happy life. It's not without its work. I'm sure you know, a lot of people, a lot of listeners know, marriage is hard work. Relationships are hard work. We have ups and downs. All of that. Raising a kid is incredibly hard. All of that. And I know that these choices that I've made appear from the outside to be quite heteronormative. So, you know, the way I identify as a gay man, I live and associate with a lot of people. I'm part of a population that is marginalized in our world. I get that. And at the same time, I think I've been able to leverage my privilege as a white person in the U.S., as a man, well, as a white person in a largely racially insensitive world, as a man in a world that favors men over women, that I've been able to leverage that privilege to be able to buffer myself from a lot of the issues that come from being part of a marginalized group. So on one hand, I don't want to say that my choice is best. In order to get through it, you have to look like a straight couple. You have to behave like a straight couple. So on one hand, that makes me uncomfortable. On the other hand, those are the choices that I've made, and I'm happy with them. But what I also like to remind people a lot is, particularly around the gay rights movement, a significant moment in the gay rights movement was Stonewall, which was orchestrated by a bunch of drag queens who were the most marginalized, were the people who were despised and beat up by the police and arrested. And those people stood up for themselves and said, we're not going to take it anymore, in a way that became part of a legacy that I have benefited from significantly. So I'm not trying to suggest that people who are heteronormative or who make choices that align or look most closely like a straight person or a straight couple are sort of the future of the movement or any of that, because I think people's experiences are varied and diverse. And I mean, just like you asked me early on, you know, whether in my own experience, I sort of had a sense, or other people had a sense of me as being effeminate or not. We all know that boys who are effeminate are marginalized and get messages all the time that are negative about themselves. You might say the same thing about masculine women. So those people are those people, and I want to live in a world where those people's choices would be honored as much as the choices that I've made. I just think there's this range of experience, and I'm not trying to suggest that my choices are the right or the only ones, though I know they've worked for me and have contributed to what I've been able to enjoy as an out gay person who's living a full and good life.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. To drive to the sand, your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard. 'Tis not so. Why should we think too? did.